Chapter 6. The Curaçao Experiment. The whole island jumped. Lucio Antonio, Curaçao Little League parent. The earthquake. Every August at the Little League World Series in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, a team of 11 and 12-year-old boys from Curaçao stages a vivid reenactment of David versus Goliath. Actually, it's more like David versus 15 Goliaths. In a 16-team tournament, frequently dominated by hulking, flame-throwing man-boys, this wiry, undersized team of nobodies from a tiny, remote Caribbean island somehow keeps succeeding. In 2007, the average player from the American Midwest team stood 5'7" and weighed 136 pounds. Curaçao's average player was 5'1" tall and weighed 106 pounds. In a worldwide competition where qualifying 2 consecutive years is considered a remarkable achievement, the Curaçao boys have made it to the semi-finals 6 times in the last 8 years, winning the title in 2004 and finishing second in 2005. As ESPN announcers have christened it, Curaçao is the little island that could. Curaçao's accomplishments are even more impressive for the fact that compared with the teams they beat, they have precious few facilities. There are only 2 Little League regulation fields on the entire island, and 1 batting cage constructed of tattered fishnet. What's more, the Curaçao baseball season lasts but 5 months. Practices are held 3 times a week, and games are on weekends, a schedule that contrasts markedly with the year-round approach of other places like Venezuela. When I saw them in Williamsport at the 2007 series, the younger members of the Curaçao team were bemused by the spectacle of the Japanese team doing drills before breakfast. "Why do they do that?" one player asked me, mystified. The most compelling element of this underdog story, however, is that Curaçao's success can be traced to a single moment of ignition. Actually, 2 moments, lasting approximately 3 seconds each. They both happened at Yankee Stadium on October the 20th, 1996, in the opening game of the World Series between the Atlanta Braves and the New York Yankees. Like many moments of ignition, this one fascinates because it hangs so heavily on chance. Literally on the postage stamp size area of contact created when a round bat meets a round ball. 1/8 of an inch either way, and, if history is any guide, the Curaçao phenomenon would not have happened. The situation at Yankee Stadium seemed unpromising. No score, top of the 2nd inning, Braves runner on first base. An unknown 19-year-old Curaçaoan rookie named Andrew Jones stood at the plate waggling his bat, a Mona Lisa smile creasing his chubby face. Jones had started his season at the single A level of the minor leagues. He'd been promoted to the majors only 2 months earlier. The Yankee ace, Andy Pettit, stared him down with the somber expression of a bullfighter. Pettit was only a few years older, but in this image, the narrative was clear. Canny veteran versus naive rookie. Pettit worked the count full, then unleashed his best pitch, a nasty slider. The intention was to induce the rookie to do what most rookies do in that situation, get fooled, reach for the pitch, and ground it into a double play. But Jones was not most rookies. Jones recognized the spin on the slider and slammed the pitch 10 rows into the left field seats. 56,000 Yankee fans went quiet as Jones, his smile broadening, sped around the bases. It was an extraordinary feat, one that couldn't possibly be outdone. But then it was. The very next inning, Jones walked up to the plate and, on another full-count pitch, smashed an even more towering drive into the left field seats. The television announcers gasped and stammered as if solving a difficult mathematical equation. World Series plus Yankee Stadium plus unknown teenager equals 2 consecutive home runs? A nuclear burst of media attention followed, hailing Jones's natural-born talent, comparing him to Clemente, Mantle, and Da Vinci, marvelling at the unearthly God-given quickness of his wrists. In fact, that quickness was no gift from above. Jones had been swinging a bat since the age of two, coached by his father, Henry. When he was older, Andrew swung a sledgehammer three times a week, rolling his wrists in a circle to build hand speed and strength. As Jones later put it, "My dad taught me baseball stuff, to work my ass off." The Hall of Fame in Cooperstown requested Jones's bat. Agence France-Presse called it the greatest debut in World Series history. Like a shockwave, Jones's historic feat flashed on screens around the world. But all that was nothing compared to the blast that rocked Jones's hometown of Willemstad. Curaçao's Little League founder Frank Curiel remembers the sound he heard when Jones hit the home runs. It was very, very loud. Firecrackers, yelling, everyone shouting, everyone waking up. A few weeks later, at Little League sign-ups, the first aftershock showed up in the form of 400 new kids. Their motivation was perhaps all the stronger, since they knew that Jones hadn't even been one of the best players on the island. As a 15-year-old, he had switched from third base to outfield so he could get more playing time. After all, if he could do it. Interestingly, the same pattern occurred among mile runners in their reaction to the success of Roger Bannister, who wasn't considered among the world's talents when he broke the four-minute mark. Similarly, Anna Kournikova had been routinely defeated by many of her tennis teammates. The peers' reaction in both cases was to be incredulous and highly motivated at once. Them? Even with this extraordinary infusion of enthusiastic recruits, Curaçao's talent bloom took time to develop, just as it did for Russia's tennis players and South Korea's golfers. After all, myelin doesn't grow overnight. Not until 2001, 5 years after Jones's home runs, did a team of Curaçao Little Leaguers arrive at Howard J. LeMud Stadium in Williamsport to compete in the Little League World Series, LLWS. Tournament officials considered it a fluke appearance. After all, Curaçao had qualified for the LLWS only once before, back in 1980. And, as LLWS press officer Christopher Downs put it, Curaçao had always been pretty miserable. But the Curaçao team, half of which had originally signed up after Jones's homers, surprised observers by reaching the international final. Though they lost 2-1 to the eventual champions from Tokyo, they had succeeded at establishing the Giant Slayer plotline that they faithfully followed ever since. As is true of any talent hotbed, Curaçao's success wasn't caused solely by the primal signals that created ignition. The matrix of other causes includes disciplined culture, top-notch coaching, supportive parents, national pride, the love of the game, and of course a wealth of deep practice. From what I saw, Jones's style of training is the rule, not the exception. Curaçao is interesting for another reason. A few dozen miles west lies the island of Aruba. Aruba is like Curaçao in almost every measurable way. They have the same population, the same language, the same Dutch-influenced culture, and the same love of baseball. Even their flags are nearly carbon copies. Aruba fields quality little league teams that, until recently, competed well against Curaçao's. To top it off, Aruba had even produced a major league player who was, for a moment in 1996, regarded as a better prospect than Andrew Jones. That star's name was Sidney Ponson, and his early success with the Baltimore Orioles, like that of Jones with the Braves, had fueled Aruban Little League with a fresh spark of excitement and participation. The two islands were twins, right down to the motivational spark, and yet Curaçao ignited while Aruba did not. Why? Part of the answer is that Curaçao, like other talent hotbeds, has found a way to do a very important and tricky thing, to keep the motivational fire lit. It's one thing to persuade Scrooge to crack open his vault. It's another to persuade him to splurge on Christmas geese day after day, year after year. Curaçao forms, quite by accident, a natural case study on the science and practice of sustained ignition. The Sistine Chapel Effect. Ignition, in Curaçao or anywhere, doesn't come with guarantees. For every breakthrough performance that ignites a talent bloom, there are dozens of breakthroughs that peter out. Germany's Boris Becker won Wimbledon at 17, but inspired no Teutonic wave of players. Miguel Cervantes dazzled the Shakespearean era with Don Quixote, but had little apparent effect in his native Spain. The painter Edvard Munch, The Scream, remains the sole member of that oxymoronic group, Norwegian Expressionists. These cases, and others like them, lead us to an interesting question. Why do breakthrough performances sometimes ignite talent blooms and sometimes not? The answer is that talent hotbeds possess more than a single primal cue. They contain complex collections of signals, people, images, and ideas that keep ignition going for the weeks, months, and years that skill growing requires. Talent hotbeds are to primal cues what Las Vegas is to neon signs, flashing with the kind of signals that keep motivation burning. Consider the sights that a young Michelangelo would have encountered in a single afternoon in Florence. In a half-hour's stroll, he could have visited the workshops of a dozen great artists. These were not quiet studios. To the contrary, they were beehives overseen by a master and a hustling team of journeymen and apprentices, competing for commissions, filling orders, making plans, testing new techniques. He could have encountered Donatello's St. Mark statue, Ghiberti's Gates of Paradise, the works of painters from his boss Ghirlandaio through Masaccio, Giotto, and Cimabue. The greatest hits of architecture, painting, and sculpture, all of them were concentrated within a few blocks. All of them were simply part of the landscape of everyday life, and all flashed signals that added up to one energizing message: better get busy. Or consider the scene at the Mermaid Tavern in London during Shakespeare's day. There, across the river from the Globe Theatre, the major writers of the day, Marlowe, Jonson, Donne, Raleigh, gathered to talk shop and match wits. Or consider the Academy and Lyceum of Athens, where Plato, Aristotle and the rest taught, argued and learned. Or consider the thronging environs of Sao Paulo, where, walking around one afternoon, I attempted to keep track of the number of signals about soccer I spotted. A TV highlight, a billboard, an overheard conversation, 4 futsal pickup games, 5 kids juggling balls down the street. I lost track somewhere after 50. Frank Curiel Field in Willemstad, Curaçao, doesn't look much like ancient Greece. It has dented aluminium bleachers, a snack shack behind home plate, and on the day I've come to watch practice, a sprinkling of parents sipping Cokes and shooting the breeze. The teams are warming up for a game, playing catch, kidding around. It looks like a slightly more decrepit version of every small-town baseball field you've ever seen. But that's only camouflage. In fact, when I examine it more closely, I see that it's cluttered with primal cues. The first cue stands 6 feet tall, wears an immaculate floral shirt, and carries a small red cup filled with Dewars and Red Bull. This is Frank Curiel himself, the 68-year-old league founder, groundskeeper, scheduler, seller of the Cokes, controller of the lights, keeper of the trophies, and benign ruler of this tiny kingdom. He is a tropical Don Corleone, a resemblance underlined by his hoarse whisper of a voice. Curiel shows me around his field, outlining his story as we walk. How he brought Little League to the island 45 years ago, how he saw the great Clemente play in Puerto Rico, how he decided to start a league, how he went to Springfield College in Massachusetts to learn physical education, how he got a job with Curaçao's Sports and Recreation Agency, how he would drive around Willemstad's neighborhoods to recruit kids to play. They played, he said, then their kids played, and now their kids play. I see them all. In describing devoted organizers like Curiel, it's customary to state that they live at the field. With Curiel, this is no figure of speech. His home is a 10-by-12-foot tin-roofed shack that sits atop steel pilings just behind home plate. A swatch of chain-link fence prevents foul balls from flying into his soup. The room is a riotous flood of trophies, plaques, equipment and photos which threaten to overrun the bed and the television that are among Curiel's few concessions to domesticity. Curiel is always around, watching, raking the field, running the lights, keeping the kids in line. Below, on a porch that serves as a wall of fame, Curiel has posted more photos of the greatest moments in the island's baseball history. Some nights, Curiel sets up the television on the porch so the kids can gather and watch big league games, or, as happens often, a scratchy videotape of Andrew Jones's homers. With a princely gaze, Curiel surveys his domain. "To play ball, you need three things," he pronounces, touching his body as if doing the sign of the cross. "Heart, mind, balls. If you have two, you can play, but you will never be great. To be great, all three." We walk around the field. Near third base, Curiel stops to correct a small boy fielding a grounder. He speaks in a burst of Papiamento, the native language, which sounds like a reggae record played backward at high speed. Curiel is telling the boy to move in front of the ball. "Like this," he demonstrates, setting down his dewars, scooping an imaginary ball and firing it to an invisible base. "Like this, yes!" The boy watches, nods, and does it. Behind the backstop, seated at a cement table, are two men talking into small headsets. They are preparing the weekly radio broadcast of the game on Curaçao Radio via a homemade setup. Next to them stands a man in a red baseball cap. His name is Fermin Coronel, and he's a scout for the St. Louis Cardinals, one of several big league scouts who live on the island. Around them sit the parents, whose casual demeanor belies their detailed knowledge of tactics and history. "Watch this boy. He has a good change-up," a 50-something mother warns me. Another man tells me of his 11-year-old son's private workouts, which include jogging 3 times a week and using dumbbells to build core strength. "It's the same workout Jurgens used," the father says, reverting to Jair Jurgens, a highly regarded second-year pitcher with the Atlanta Braves, whose father, by the way, is standing just over there by the backstop. Then there are the kids. At the top of this loose hierarchy are the older teens who play junior league ball and help coach. Many of them have been to Williamsport and still wear their battered LLWS caps as badges of honour. Then come waves of increasingly younger kids, the ones for whom the LLWS is a fresh memory, the ones who return telling stories of jet flights and plasma televisions, of getting to meet major league stars, and seeing themselves on ESPN. Then come the ones who are trying to make the All-Star team this year. They're the most serious of all. And finally, the loose packs of 4- and 5-year-old kids who tumble in and out of the proceedings like so many kittens, watchful and quick. Frank Curiel Field is not so much a field as a window through which these kids can see the ascending realms of heaven stacked above them in neat levels, as in a medieval painting. First comes making the league all-star team, being one of those guys. Then comes Williamsport in all its celebrity glory, being one of those guys. Then, just above that, is getting signed by a scout, playing in the major leagues, being one of those guys. For the kids at Frank Curiel Field, these are not gauzy dreams or glossy posters. They are tangible steps on a primal ladder of selection. Distinct possibilities reflected in the crackle of the radio, the clutter of the trophies, the chrome glint off the major league scout's sunglasses. See that house down the street, the one with the nice SUV in the driveway? That's Andrew Jones's mum's house. To be a 6-year-old at this field is, motivationally speaking, sort of like standing in the Sistine Chapel. The proof of paradise is right here. All you have to do is open your eyes. The most vivid example of the power of selection I came across was from 1987 at Spartak Tennis Club. The coach, Rauza Islanova, started her class with 25 7-year-olds. Every second week or so she would reduce it by one. Of the 7 who made the final selection, 3 became world top 10 players. Yelena Dementieva, Anastasia Miskina and Marat Safin. "Not bad for one class," Dementieva said. Late one evening in Curaçao, I was driving round Willemstad with Filbert Llewellyn. Like most of the adults around Curacao Little League, Llewellyn had several jobs: coach, colour announcer on the radio broadcast, and lieutenant in the police department. Around 8 p.m, Llewellyn's cell phone rang, and I assumed it was police business. In fact, it was two of his ball players who desperately needed him to settle an important bet about an obscure baseball rule. Llewellyn rendered his decision. No, the batter does not get credit for a sacrifice if the runner on second tags and goes to third. Hung up and smiled apologetically. That happens a lot, he said. I have coached Little League Baseball off and on for more than a decade now, and I've received calls from players wanting to know about schedules, uniform numbers, and pizza parties, not to mention the occasional player who has a crush on my wife and wonders if maybe he can talk to her. But I've yet to get a phone call from two players arguing over the finer points of the sacrifice fly rule. They are thinking about baseball, Llewellyn said with a policeman's knowing shrug. All the time, it's going around and around inside their heads. Let's return to the question with which we began. Why did Curacao succeed in starting a hotbed while Aruba failed? Why, given the equality of gene pool, culture and inspirational spark, didn't Aruba ignite? Beyond the factors already noted, we should also consider the fate of their respective igniters. Sidney Ponson, the Aruban pitcher who was such a marvellous prospect, turned out to have a drinking problem. He became overweight, bounced around to several teams, and on Christmas Day 2004 was arrested for assault and ordered to take part in 27 hours of anger management classes. Andrew Jones, on the other hand, became a 5-time All-Star and 10-time Gold Glove centre fielder. The larger reason, however, is that Curacao possessed a set of tools to keep the ignition of Jones's success lit. Curacao grew talent because the message of Jones's success was translated and amplified into a reliable combination of primal cues. Frank Curiel Field, after all, only looks like a beat-up baseball diamond. It is, in fact, a million-watt antenna steadily transmitting a powerful stream of signals and images that add up to a thrilling whisper. Hey, that could be you. The language of ignition. Thus far, we've learned a few things about the nature of our ignition switch. First, it's either on or off. Second, it can be triggered by certain signals or primal cues. Now we'll look more deeply into how it can be triggered by the signals we use most. Words. As experts in motivational psychology go, Skip Engblom does not fit the usual mold. He's a big, shambling, libertarian skate shop owner from Santa Monica, California. Engblom, you might recall, helped found the Z-Boys skateboarding team. The mumbly, mercurial, genius, stoner quintessence of his personality was captured by Heath Ledger in Lords of Dogtown, the feature film about the Z-Boys. The years have left Engblom largely unchanged, except for two things. First, his once shaggy locks have been replaced by a gleaming Buddha dome. Second, he's gained new insights into his role in the Z-Boys' evolution from their random beginnings to their storied triumph at the 1975 Del Mar Skateboard Contest. Insights that resonate best if he explains them himself. Here's the setup to his story. It's the early 1970s, and a handful of sketchy-looking kids start hanging around Engblom's surf shop after school. I saw them, but I didn't say anything at first. First, I wanted to make sure they weren't shoplifting or something, but when I saw they were being cool, I let them be. Everybody else would have kicked them out. But they were okay. I grew up without a dad, and I knew their deal. They kind of reminded me of me. You know what I mean? In Engblomese, this last phrase comes out, you know what I mean? So we started spending time. It wasn't much. We went to the beach, surfed. I fed them. I saw they were really good surfers, some of these guys, so we entered this contest. So this one Saturday, the contest comes along, and there's this guy who was supposed to be the guy. You know what I mean? He's some big-shot ringer dude who's going to turn pro or something. So I'm like the coach, right? And so I decide to put our smallest surfer, this little kid named Jay Adams, up against this pro guy in the first heat. Jay was 13. I knew Jay could do it, but Jay didn't know he could. He had no idea. So we're standing there getting ready for the contest, and people are gathered round, and they're freaking out that Jay and this guy are going to surf against each other. They're saying, whoa, no way. So that's when I go up to this big shot pro guy, right where Jay can hear me. I tell the guy, don't worry, bud, you don't stand a chance. And Jay goes out and slaughters the guy. Jay beats the guy who was supposed to be the guy. That's when everything changed. The kids saw that and went, whoa. We started getting good at that moment. They felt it. They took that to the waves and to the street when we started that up. And Jay was the one who had the idea, you know? The one who said we should start a skateboard team. When it came to skateboards, we got all systematic about it. Practiced a couple of hours a day, 4 days a week. There's no instant gratification, man. Everything boils back down to training, doing it over and over. So I never said much. I would just be mellow and say, good job, dude, or nice shred. And sometimes something to up the ante, toss in a little carrot, you know, like, I heard so-and-so did that trick last week. And then they'd all be trying like crazy to do that one. You know what I mean? Because they wanted to be part of the equation. When they showed up at that contest in Del Mar, everybody made it seem like it was some big surprise. But the Z-Boys knew exactly what was going to happen. They knew because they knew exactly how good they were, because they were trained up, because they knew. Not because I told them they could. But I helped them get there, definitely. Engblom pauses, thinks deeply, and issues his wisdom. Here's the deal. You've got to give kids credit at a younger age for feeling stuff more acutely. When you say something to a kid, you've got to know what you're saying to them. The stuff you say to a kid starting out, you've got to be super careful. You know what I mean? What skill building really is confidence building. First, they got to earn it. Then they got it. And once it gets lit, it stays lit pretty good. On one level, Engblom didn't do all that much. His communications with the team consisted of a few mumbled phrases. Some of them set up a highly specific challenge at key moments. Don't worry, bro, you don't have a chance. I heard so-and-so did that trick last week. Others encouraged their efforts. Good job, dude. Nice shred. And yet, without Engblom, without his verbal signals and his guidance, the Z-Boys might never have happened, much less succeeded. It's as if those few off-hand phrases, small as they were, somehow helped ignite them to new levels of motivation and effort. And according to theories developed by Dr. Carol Dweck, Engblom's verbal cues, however minimal, are just the kind to send the right signal. Dweck is a social psychologist at Stanford who has spent the past 30 years studying motivation. She's carved an impressively varied path across the field, starting with animal motivation and shifting to more complex creatures, chiefly elementary and high school students. Some of her most eye-opening research involves the relationship between motivation and language. Left to our own devices, we go along in a pretty stable mindset, she said. But when we get a clear cue, a message that sends a spark, then, boing, we respond. The boing phenomenon can be seen most vividly in a series of experiments Dweck did with 400 New York fifth graders. The study was a scientific version of the fable The Princess and the Pea. Its goal was to see how much a tiny signal, a single sentence of praise, can affect performance and effort, and what kind of signal is most effective. First, Dweck gave every child a test that consisted of fairly easy puzzles. Afterward, the researcher informed all the children of their scores, adding a single six-word sentence of praise. Half of the kids were praised for their intelligence, you must be smart at this, and half were praised for their effort, you must have worked really hard. The kids were tested a second time, but this time they were offered a choice between a harder test and an easier test. 90% of the kids who'd been praised for their effort chose the harder test. A majority of the kids who'd been praised for their intelligence, on the other hand, chose the easy test. Why? When we praise children for their intelligence, Dweck wrote, we tell them that's the name of the game. Look smart, don't risk making mistakes. The third level of tests was uniformly harder. None of the kids did well. However, the two groups of kids, the praised for effort group and the praised for intelligence group, responded very differently to the situation. The effort group dug in and grew very involved with the test, trying solutions, testing strategies, Dweck said. They later said they liked it. But the group praised for its intelligence hated the harder test. They took it as proof they weren't smart. The experiment then came full circle, returning to a test of the same difficulty as the initial test. The praised for effort group improved their initial score by 30%, while the praised for intelligence group score declined by 20%. All because of six short words. Dweck was so surprised at the result that she re-ran the study five times. Each time, the result was the same. We are exquisitely attuned to messages telling us what is valued, Dweck said. I think we go around all the time looking, trying to understand, who am I in this setting? Who am I in this framework? So that when a clear message comes, it can send a spark. True to the findings of Dweck's study, each of the hotbeds I visited used language that affirmed the value of effort and slow progress rather than innate talent or intelligence. At Spartak, for instance, they did not play tennis. They preferred the verb borotsia, fight or struggle. South Korean golfers are exhorted to yun sup hee, which translates to Nike's possible delight as just do it. In Curaçao, the 9 to 10-year-olds play in the Liga Vraminga, the little ant league. The watchword is progressa, baby steps. In Brazilian soccer, the age levels are the bottle, 5 and 6-year-olds, diapers, 7 and 8, and pacifier, 9 and 10. The under-20 national team is called the aspirantes, the hopeful ones. The English call their youth team the reserves, Emilio Miranda told me, chortling. What are they reserved for? At all the places I visited, praise was not constant, but was given only when it was earned. A finding that dovetails with the research of Dweck, who notes that motivation does not increase with increased levels of praise, but often dips. Remember, our study showed the effect that just six words can have, Dweck said. It's all about clarity. When we use the term motivational language, we are generally referring to language that speaks of hopes, dreams, and affirmations. You are the best! This kind of language, let's call it high motivation, has its role. But the message from Dweck and the hotbeds is clear. High motivation is not the kind of language that ignites people. What works is precisely the opposite. Not reaching up, but reaching down. Speaking to the ground-level effort, affirming the struggle. Dweck's research shows that phrases like, wow, you really tried hard, or good job, dude, motivate far better than what she calls empty praise. From the myelin point of view, this conclusion makes sense. Praising effort works because it reflects biological reality. The truth is, skill circuits are not easy to build. Deep practice requires serious effort and passionate work. The truth is, when you are starting out, you do not play tennis. You struggle and fight and pay attention and slowly get better. The truth is, we learn in staggering baby steps. Effort-based language works because it speaks directly to the core of the learning experience. And when it comes to ignition, there's nothing more powerful. If I was a college, my success rate would be pretty good. You know why me? Engblom said. I mean, 80 or 85% of my guys end up successful businessmen, athletes, millionaires. You can't say that about Harvard. Engblom would like to mention that he's free to talk to corporations or schools or anybody else to, advise them on personnel issues. I got a lot of thoughts on this stuff.